Good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank the Frohlich Financial Group, as always, for sponsoring our afternoon kollel. Also want to thank our particular sponsors for today, the Bromberg family, in honor of Ya'ara Aliza's bat mitzvah. Mazel tov, you should have a lot of nachas. We are up to part three, which is, I believe, the final part of the series that we've been doing on cruise considerations, halachas of going on a cruise. And as we've said, many or most of these areas are not particular to a cruise, but could be relevant to a hotel, could be relevant to a vacation, a resort, sometimes a Pesach program, in a lot of different scenarios, but particularly as we are counting down, and some communities have even begun Yeshiva Week, which a lot of people go on vacation, these things come up and are very relevant. So in the first two parts, we covered a lot of questions revolving around the issue of Shabbos. When can you embark on the cruise? Can you get off and get back on the cruise if it docks on Shabbos? What about a metal detector, electric door, a sensor on the lights, or a sensor on the air conditioning? Discuss the sensor even on the toilet and in the bathroom. What about, can you carry throughout the ship? Does the ship need an Erev Chatzeros in addition to the Erev? We talked about lighting candles. Where do you light and what can you light? Can you use an electric candle? We talked about Kiddush cup. What if you don't have one? What can be used as a substitute? Can you use a disposable Kiddush cup? What if you don't have grape juice or wine? What do you use? Havdalah. And lastly, sealed kosher meals, if they were heated for you, how do you avoid the prohibition of Maisa Shabbos? Those were the topics we covered in the first two parts. And if you missed them or would like to review them, you can listen to them online. And it brings us to this third part. And the third part, as Jews, one of the core reasons we go on vacation, and one of the core pleasures we experience on vacation, of course, is to eat. We enjoy good food. We enjoy even non-good food. We just like eating. So the question is, there's a lot of kashrus considerations, kashrus concerns that come up in the context of a cruise, that come up in the context of a vacation. So the simplest way is to sign up for a extraordinarily expensive kosher cruise. And then you've got a Pesach program at sea. You've got a shmorg and a buffet. You can eat what you want, assuming it's under a legitimate, valid hashgacha, and you trust their supervision and the quality of their kashrus control, then es gesund, eat, enjoy, have a great vacation. That in itself is not so simple. I'll tell you, the ORB, prior to my time, used to supervise cruises and change that policy, not because of a particular incident that they had, but incidents within the kashrus community at large. And the ORB changed its standard and practice to not supervise a cruise unless the entire cruise were kosher, which in many cases these cruise ships can hold literally thousands of people, up to 4,000 passengers. It's a whole city at sea, and often it's not 4,000 kosher consumers, and they're not converting all of the kitchens. But the challenge of multiple kitchens, multiple dining rooms, intermediate areas, the necessary level of supervision is so complicated and so challenging that the ORB got out of the cruise business unless it'd be entirely kosher. Similarly, just parenthetically, we've changed the standard for Pesach programs as well, that the whole Pesach program has to be, whole hotel has to be kosher for Pesach. Otherwise, multiple dining rooms and kelim and chefs and ingredients, it is very, very complicated. Now, can you rely on a lot of kulas? Can you rely on a lot of leniencies? This is an area of Jewish law where a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. So you have a lot of Jews with a little bit of Jewish education, and they start arguing, what about bittul? What about bidyeved? What about hefsed meruba? What about this? What about this? What about that? And what about the other thing? And there are halachic arguments to be made. But do you want to live your life as a bidyeved Jew or a lechatchila Jew? Is it such an urgent situation, a person has to put themselves in such a situation to have to rely on leniencies and loopholes and after the fact? Or do we want to live a lifestyle where we are engaging only in the highest level of observance and of commitment and of Yiras Shamayim? So I don't want to spend time or dwell on this, but when choosing where to vacation and the standard that's being observed, it's important to do a little bit of research. My dear friend and a real authority in the world today on kashrus, Rabbi Fishbane of the CRC, wrote before Pesach this year, 10 things to look for in a Pesach hotel, 10 questions to ask before you agree to go there. There, you know, it's not just so simple that you see a bunch of Hebrew writing, or Yiddish writing even more, and a Hamisha Hashkacha, and then, oh, it's a Hamisha Hashkacha, it's got the It's got the support of some Admor, some Rebbe. It must be good. This Hebrew lettering, it must be good. Kashrus was never so simple, and today is far from so simple. And we are accountable. The same standards that we would ask, the questions we would ask when choosing a lawyer to represent us, or the person who will do our taxes, or the doctor who will treat our health, or whatever standards are going to be approved in our home of our smoke detector or our car and so on, person should be very, very careful. So I'll leave it at that. It's not so simple. So the simplest thing is to go on a kosher cruise with a kashrus agency you trust. Below that is to, of course, order the kosher meals. Now, ordering the kosher meals can have the following concerns to them. First of all, we already addressed if they heat those foods up for you on Shabbos. So if they heated a dry, fully cooked food up for you on Shabbos, it would not have the prohibition of Maisa Shabbos, although the non-Jew did it for you, but they did it as part of their general routine and for the whole ship. But a liquid that was heated might have a bigger problem, so if you wait until it cools below Yad Soletis Bo, below, call it 110 degrees, you're not benefiting from the malacha, the work that they did for you, and you'd be allowed to, therefore, consume it at that point. Another thing that you have to be careful of, not on Shabbos, during the week, is that the kosher meals that are being heated on your behalf are double wrapped. And you have to make sure that the double wrapping is not compromised, is not punctured, because if it is, it can compromise the kashrus integrity of the food. So ideally, you should receive it with its double wrapping so that you yourself can see that in fact was double wrapped and you can open it. There are some settings where they'll ask you, you know, often if it's a business setting and you've got a special meal and they want to know, would you like us to unwrap it in the back, or do you want us to basically announce publicly that you're a Jew and anti-Semites should know exactly where you're sitting and not to do business with you? So there are some situations where maybe you go back there with them and you see it and you allow them to open it back there, in certain other situations. But generally speaking, a person should see the double wrapping. How does the double wrapping help? Why does the double? What's the magic of your food being double wrapped? How does that help with your food being heated? You may notice on airlines as well. Or if a person is strict, even on El Al, which is a Jewish airline and is ostensibly all kosher, not everything is kosher, not because the airline standards aren't kosher, but you don't know what else is going in that oven. You don't know what flight attendant is sticking whatever they are choosing to heat of their own personal meal in that oven. And there's absolutely no way of knowing the integrity of that oven. And for us, kashrus is no less of a threat or a danger or a standard than an allergy. The Ramban on Torah describes, based on Chazal, that the reason we're so careful with kashrus is metamtei mesalev. It literally, we believe, halachically and in Jewish philosophy, that you are what you eat, that we absorb the quality and the character of that which we consume. The Ramban talks about it in the context of which birds are prohibited because they're birds of prey. Their predisposition towards cruelty is something which is inherent and ingrained within the very flesh, within the very substance of the bird. And if you eat it, then we absorb that personality and that character. We are what we eat. It's metamteim es halev. So much so that we have to be careful and strict with children, even who don't necessarily rise to a level of observance yet before the age of chinuch, but we don't want to compromise what they eat, what they consume. It will have an impact on them. There's a beautiful Emes LeYaakov, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal, who notes, we're about to start this week, we're reading Parsha Shmos. It's very timely and apropos, and I reserve the right to repeat it tomorrow at the Parsha class, as it just occurs to me that we're beginning Sefer Shmos. Moshe Rabbeinu is born, his life is saved by Bisya, the daughter of Paro, and it's time for Moshe. He needs to be able to, they don't have Similac, there's no formula, there's no alternative. He needs to be nursed in order to live. So we know that what was arranged in order to ensure that he would be able to nurse from a Jewish source and not consume the milk from a non-Jewish woman. Why? Is there a kashrus concern of the milk of a non-Jewish woman? All milk of all human beings is kosher. Unlike the animal kingdom, not only is the milk of a human being kosher, and Yerodeh the Shulchan Aruch tells us a woman's milk is parav. It is not only kosher, it is parav. Of course, it's inappropriate for an adult to consume such milk from its source, but not from its source. If we're already in a bottle or pumped, technically it's kosher and it is parav. So why was there such an effort made for Moshe Rabbeinu to only nurse from a Jewish woman? So Rashi quotes Chazal on our Pasha, that the peh, the mouth that was destined to speak directly with God, should not taste, should not consume from a non-Jewish, non-kosher, not technically non-kosher, but from a non-Jewish source, a non-Jewish origin, and that's why the effort was made. Shulchan Aruch quotes this lahalacha. The Shulchan Aruch says, of course, nursing from a non-Jewish woman is perfectly kosher, but ideally if one can arrange for a baby to only nurse from a Jewish source, that is more ideal. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal asks, he says, I don't understand. Moshe Rabbeinu, it's one of the Yud Gimel, one of the 13 principles of our faith, is to believe that Moshe is categorically different. He's the Ava Nevi'im. Moshe is unique, he's singular. He exclusively was destined to speak directly, pale pale with God. So we understand why that stringency, why that strictness was carried out for him. But why would it be a standard that we would try to hold our own children to? And Rav Yaakov has such an important and brilliant insight. He says a Jewish parent has to look at their baby and say, you could be the next Moshe Rabbeinu. You could be the next Moshe Rabbeinu. The potential we believe in our children is to hold the same standard as Moshe Rabbeinu. That we don't say, you're born at Chutzlartz, you're born to such Oisvarf parents, you're born to such, we have such low expectations of you. We say the opposite. You have the capacity, you have the potential to be a Moshe Rabbeinu, so you have to observe the same standard. So this is a stringency. We know we live in a world of, there's a proliferation of allergies. The more sterilized the world we live in, counterintuitively, the more of a spread of allergies there is. That's why there's some research that shows, where's the country with the fewest peanut allergies? Israel. Why? Bamba. Because every kid grows up eating bamba. There's bamba everywhere, so there's fewer peanut allergy there. But you know here, if you've taken a flight, it's not infrequent that they come on and they say, we have a passenger with a peanut allergy, and therefore, not only are we not serving any snacks with peanuts, we ask you that if you have anything with any peanut, it can't enter the air system of the plane, leave it sealed in your bag, please take it out, don't take it out, it can be lethal for a person. That level of stringency, of vigilance, that level of being scrupulous for an allergy is the standard that we are expected to keep in the world of kashrus. We are allergic. It's metam temes alev. In ways we don't necessarily fully appreciate, but we absorb that which we eat. It's metam temes alev. It compromises us, and therefore we need to be extremely, extremely careful. So how does it work? Let's come back. On an airline, you have a non-kosher oven. At a resort, on a cruise, you have a non-kosher oven. You're invited to someone's home, and they're going to get kosher food for you, but they want to heat it in the... I'll never forget, we came to Boca, it was a community kol at the time. I was a member of the community kol. I was very involved in outreach. We had the first explanatory service through the Boca Raton Synagogue. And there was a family who we became very close with, and we had over many times, and they wanted to reciprocate. They had a magnificent estate, a place called Horseshoe Acres with horses and barns. It was magnificent. And they bought in food. They bought from a kosher place. But either I had failed to tell them or they had forgotten. But when I happened to be in the kitchen, I saw they had uncovered everything and was being heated in their oven. Or maybe they asked me about it. And I still vividly remember one of their children telling me, Rabbi, can't you just bless the food and it'll all be okay? Can't you just bless it and then we could eat it? So why can't you just bless it and then we could eat it? What was the matter with their non-kosher oven having heated up the food? So we know that we have what's called be'en, we have mamashus. We have the actual foodstuff itself that can either be a kosher source or a non-kosher source. But we also have another principle called ta'am ki'ikr. Ta'am means the taste of the food, even without the mamashus, the presence of the actual food, has significance. The Gemara elaborates and goes through four or five or six different possibilities. What is the origin, the source, the makor of this principle called ta'am ki'ikr? But it's a very significant notion, the notion of ta'am. Ta'am means if I have a utensil and it is sparkling clean, I've cleaned it incredibly, but it previously absorbed non-kosher taste, where it first absorbed dairy taste and now it absorbed fleshic, meat taste. And therefore the taste is embedded in the wall of the pot. So if anyone who's not following halacha were to look at the pot, they'd say, that is a clean pot. You could comb your hair in the wall of the pot, it's sparkling clean, you can see your reflection, it's a beautiful clean pot. But halachically it's filthy. If it has a tam, if it is absorbed through heat, the transfer of a taste of a non-kosher source. Tam ki'ikr. How do you get the taste out of a pot? You have to kasher, kabolo kach polto. The way it was absorbed is the way it's purged. If it's absorbed through a liquid medium, it's purged through liquid. Absorbed through heat, it's purged through heat, i.e. a blowtorch or a self-clean setting on an oven. The way is if it's absorbed through steam, it's purged through steam. So what's an example of that? A microwave. How does a microwave become non-kosher? For that matter, how does an oven, assuming the food that was heated in it didn't spill, how do the walls of the oven, how does the chamber of the oven become non-kosher? So halacha differentiates between what's called recha and zeya. The Gemara has a machlokas whether recha milsa or not, whether recha it's more than the smell, but whether that has, do we consider recha milsa, is the smell significant? So if you heat two foods together, you eat something with onions and now your other food smells like onions. Nothing actually transferred from one to the other than the smell. If you've ever been in a kitchen when a certain recipe is being cooked and you walk out and then you run into someone and they say, where were you just now? You smell like such and such. Now, it didn't transfer to you. There was no heat. You didn't even eat it. You didn't even touch it. But recha is significant. So recha, lechatchila, was shouldn't be makbid, but b'dievet, we paskin, one can be lenient that the transfer of reach itself would not be significant. But zeya, which is steam, or zeya, which is even thicker, vapor, does have significance, zeya. So therefore, take your microwave. If you heat something in a microwave and it's uncovered and it produces steam, the hot steam has the status of mamashus, status of the food itself that produced the steam, and the steam gets embedded in the walls of the microwave, making your microwave not kosher. How do you then convert your microwave? How do you transform it back to be kosher? You need to get the taste out of the walls. Well, how did the taste get into the walls through zeya, through steam? You get it out. So we said, how do you kosher a pot? If the taste got there through liquid, you get it out through liquid. If it got there through heat, you get it out through heat. And if it got there through steam, then you purge it or you remove it through steam. Which is, you remember Pesach time, group of men, I could say the word Pesach without anybody breaking into hives, but you remember Pesach time, how do you kasher a microwave? You take a styrofoam or microwave safe bowl or cup, you fill it with water, and you run it on a setting high and long enough till the water heats to produce steam and fill the chamber with steam. You then move it to another location so you can kasher the spot where the kli itself was. To remove the glass tray for Pesach during the year, you wouldn't have to. Glass is a separate conversation altogether. So, taste can get imparted from kelim in utensils, and it needs to be purged from those kelim. Now, strictly speaking, for the purpose of intellectual honesty, how long can a taste last? Mamashus lasts as long as the food is edible, then it retains its status as either kosher or non-kosher. If it spoils, if it molds, if it's inedible, then it's no longer a kashrus concern or question. How long does taste last? Taste lasts for 24 hours. Meis leis. It lasts for 24 hours, a ben yomo or an eno ben yomo. So therefore, if once 24 hours goes by, after the utensil has absorbed either a non-kosher taste or meat and dairy taste, the taste by definition is pogum, it's stale, it's insignificant, it's inconsequential, and your utensil, biblically midoraisa, the utensil is restored to its kosher status by cleaning it and leaving it for 24 hours, it's automatically kosher again. Rabbinically, we said you have to treat an eino ben yomo like a ben yomo. Why? Because eino ben yomo atu ben yomo. Could you imagine in our modern kitchens how many forks, knives, spoons, serving pieces, cooking pieces? We have a million. There's not enough post-it notes in the world in order to keep track for every kli, last used Tuesday, 5:27 p.m. Last used the Wednesday, you'd mess up. Atu ben yomo, eino ben yomo, because you're going to use something which is you think is an eino ben yomo, which has been more than 24 hours, but it's within 24 hours, and the difference is enormous. If it's within 24 hours and the taste is potent, and you mix it, meat and milk, or you've consumed, you cook something that had previously absorbed non-kosher, you can violate a biblical prohibition because tam ki'ikar. If you wait 24 hours, midoraisa, it's automatically kosher. Midorabanan, we treat it as its previous status. Now, we incorporate that all the time. Some of you or people you know call or email the rabbi with questions about somebody put the fleishik liv on the milchik pot. The fleishik spoon and the milchik thing. That all the time. And what's the first question any rabbi worth their weight will ask? When was it last used? When was it last used? Because often we can save the food. Since midoraisa, it was kosher, we could say bidyevid, you can still consume the food, even though things will need to be kashered. So this is a very, very brief and simple overview of some of the rules of kalim, of kashrus, of kashering, kabola kachpolto, of zeya, how things absorb, and therefore how they're purged and the like. Now, one of the critically important principles to know is, by the way, the Yoreim had one set of dishes. He relied on the Doraisa, on the Doraisa level. We, of course, have the two sets of dishes so that we don't have to, we can't keep track of the 24 hours. We're machmir, we're makbid on the rabbinic prohibition of not to use an Eino Ben Yomo Atu, lest we come to use a Ben Yomo. Now, why does having two kelim help? Why does it help to have two utensils? Thank you. Yeah, I guess so. Why does it help to have two kelim? One of the halachic principles of the transfer of taste is, in order for taste to transfer from one kli, one utensil, to another, there has to be some mechanism or medium through which that taste is transferred. It can be done without heat. Anyone know what an example of is transferring taste without heat? Through the process of?
Kovish
kamavasho. You can pickle or brine. You can transform the status of a food. You may not know it, but your pickles used to be cucumbers until somebody immersed them and soaked them in a brine that pickled the cucumber. Pickled herring, a brine that transforms, that leaves the same result from a raw to a cooked state of food. But more often than not, taste is transferred through the presence of a combination of heat and liquid. If two kalim touch each other, if a fleshik pot, a hot fleshik pot, and a hot milchik pot on the outside touch each other, do you know what the status of both pots is? No problem at all. I'm not telling you lechatchila to set up your kitchen that way. We're careful on our stove, and the Shulchan Aruch regulates how you put things in the oven. We don't lechatchila do that because it can lead to disaster. If there's a spill or an overflow and the liquid is there and there's contact and heat, then you're going to transfer a taste. But if you have two utensils that touch and there's no liquid in between them, even if they're both hot, let alone only one is hot, no taste will transfer. And that is the secret, the magic behind the double wrapping. The reason we double wrap food to put it in a non-kosher oven is because even if non-kosher will be absorbed by the outer wrapping, it can't transfer that non-kosher taste to the inner wrapping because there's no liquid between the outer wrapping and the inner wrapping. So by double wrapping, what you're essentially doing is you're putting a kli within a kli. It's a utensil within a utensil. And with nothing in between the two utensils, no taste can transfer between them. And that is how you can achieve heating up what's at the center of those two kalim, your food, without absorbing the non-kosher from the non-kosher oven. However, if there's a hole in the outer kli, and now the inner kli is being affected by the steam from the oven, now the inner kli is making contact with a non-kosher source, then you could have a problem. That's why making sure that, in fact, that double wrapping and double seal is done and is done well is critically important in order to be able to heat up kosher food in a non-kosher oven. So again, the ideal, sign up, take out another mortgage, and go on a kosher cruise. If you can't do that, go on a regular cruise, order the kosher meal, make sure they're sent being double wrapped. What can you use to complement those kosher meals? If you're going on a cruise for anything more than a couple days, those airline meals can get a little old. What can you get that can complement those double wrapped foods on the cruise? So first of all, let's take it meal by meal. You go to the breakfast. Can you have hard-boiled eggs on the cruise? No. Why can't you have hard-boiled eggs? Because they could be cooked in a non-kosher pot. And even though there's a shell around the egg, the taste would transfer from the non-kosher pot into the egg. Not all eggs are automatically kosher, even though the egg of a kosher animal is kosher. But if it's boiled, it could create a problem. So you can't necessarily, or you can't have the eggs, hard-boiled eggs, unless you know how they were cooked. What about cut-up vegetables? So the Shulchan Aruch says you're allowed to have cut-up vegetables or cut-up fruit, assuming that there's no challenge with the insects. We'll get back to leafy vegetables or vegetables that could have a challenge with insects. If you're ordering whole fruit, raw fruit, or a whole vegetable, although I don't know who's going to serve you a whole red pepper, but even a cut-up vegetables, non-leafy, non-challenged with insects, are not a problem. So you'll say, but what about the knife? How do I know what knife they use to cut the vegetable? How do I know what knife they use to cut the fruit? Can you go locally to Publix or Winn-Dixie? Do Do you need to buy the fruit or the vegetables that have the hechsher, or can you buy the ones without the hechsher? Can you walk into any supermarket, any farmer's market, and get cut of vegetables and fruit? And the answer, you may be surprised, the Shulchan Aruch says, yes, you can buy it, not a problem. Ah, what about the knife? What if it had residue from what was previously cut? So Shulchan Aruch has a fascinating argument. It says, halachically, we're entitled to believe that our fruit or vegetable that was cut up was not the first one that was used with this knife. And therefore, if there were anything on the knife, it came off with what was cut before it got to our fruits and vegetables. So assuming you don't have a problem with insects, so non-leafy vegetables, you could be in a business setting in a non-kosher restaurant, which is its own discussion, but you could be at a hotel or a cruise or a farmer's market or a gas station or a supermarket, and you can purchase vegetables, you can purchase cut-up fruit. They don't need to have a hechsher. They are perfectly permissible. Perfectly permissible. Oh, so if there's onion... Onion, lemon is not a davacharif. An onion could be considered a davacharif, or a radish. A radish is considered a davacharif. Why is a davacharif important? Because a davacharif, a sharp item, absorbs the taste that was embedded within the kli. When you have sharpness, when you have charifus, it takes the place of heat. So just like I would revive an eino ben yomo kli, a kli that hadn't been used in 24 hours, its taste is revived by heating it up. So too, a davar charef, a sharp food item, revives the taste that was embedded, which is the whole idea of onions, being careful with onions. I don't want to get too distracted by onions. But if you cut an onion with a fleshic knife, even though the knife was cold, and you'll say, but Rabbi, you said in order to impart taste, transfer taste, you have to have heat. That's true if it's not a sharp object, but if not only sharp like the knife is sharp and the onion's sharp. They're both sharp. So, but if you're cutting an onion or a radish or something that's considered to have a sharpness to it, the process of cutting it draws out the taste that was. So it turns an eino ben yomo kli into a ben yomo. So let's say you cooked raw onions in a fleshic pot. Even if the pot hadn't been used in 24 hours, we treat it as if the pot was used in 24 hours, because that is the power and potency of the onion. Now, most poskim say this issue with onions is only true for raw onions. Let's say, and this comes up, when I'm asked a question having to do with onions, milchiks and fleshiks, the first question I ask is, was the onion raw? Had the onion already been sautéed or fried or cooked? Once the onion is cooked, its sharpness is cooked out of it, and therefore it no longer has the status, according to most poskim, of a davacharif, and it wouldn't revive or transfer taste. So yes, when you're getting your cut-up fruit and your cut-up vegetables, you need to be careful. You can't get broccoli if it hasn't been checked, a romaine lettuce, if you have no ability to check it. You shouldn't get onions or radishes. But if you're in a place, and I've had to do this myself, and you say, could you bring me a plate of cut up carrots and red pepper and green pepper and celery and cucumbers, and one could argue, depending on the season and where, even cauliflower, if you have the ability to look at the cauliflower. But there are many vegetables that you can get cut up, even if you don't know the status of the knife beforehand, and fruit certainly as well. All fruit, even cut up, you'd be allowed to get. So if you want to compliment your meal on the cruise, when you've ordered the kosher frozen meals, and you ask whoever you'll be, your server, who on cruise lines get rated, and are very eager to please, both for a tip and to get a good rating, which is very significant to them, then you could say, if you don't mind, each meal, if you could have on the table for us some cut up vegetables, some cut up fruit, you'll taste something that hasn't been nuked. That would be very good for your system. So that's in terms of... I'm sorry? Yeah, I would think hot peppers are considered a davar charef. Yeah. What else can you possibly get? What else can you possibly get? So let's stay at breakfast. Let's go meal by meal. At breakfast, you can't have the hard-boiled egg. We explained why. Because if it's cooked in a non-kosher pot, then it's going to absorb the non-kosher taste. Even all the way through the shell, you'd need to know it's kosher. Can you eat? On the cruise, do they have special pots for the boiling eggs? Not that I know of, or not that we can know with certainty were used. Can you have cereal in a non-kosher bowl on the cruise? Again, your meals come in a double-wrapped, double-sealed, impossible-to-open packaging. So in the morning, you just want to be like a normal person and take a bowl from the line at the buffet and fill it with your cereal that you know is a kosher cereal and use the milk. So milk is a discussion whether you rely on Chalav Stam. People who are Makban and Chalav Akum, or Makban and Chalav Yisrael rather, they like to say about those who rely on Rav Moshe's opinion that you drink Chalav Akum. To which I remind them, none of us are allowed to drink Chalav Akum. Rav Moshe wasn't Matir Chalav Akum. He didn't allow us to drink milk of a non-Jew. He had a third category called Chalav Stam. Right? Chalav Yisrael means that a Jew supervised the milking process to ensure the source of the milk. Chalav Akum means there's milking done with no Jewish supervision, and therefore we have to be suspicious of the source of that milk. And there's a Gzera Durabbanan, the Mishnah Avodah Zarah, you're not allowed to drink such milk. Rav Moshe was Machadesh, a third category. I gave a Chabura on it, it's my article in the upcoming Yadrim. Is Rav Moshe was Machadesh, a third category called Chalav Stam, which that we live in a society whose government regulates where the milk comes from. And so essentially what Rav Moshe said is that all milk is Chalav Yisrael. His psak about Chalav Stam is that any milk produced in America is Chalav Yisrael. The Jew is not on the farm watching it be milked. He said, yeah, Chazal, when they said the Jew had to be on the farm, did not mean the Jew has to give edus. The Jew doesn't have to give testimony. The Jew needs to have yediya. That was my chabura. Which areas of halacha require ne'emanus? So for example, kiddushin, gerushin, they require edus and ne'emanus. Erev checking, or your milk source, doesn't require ne'emanus and edus. It's not testimony of witnesses. Rather, it requires yediya. It requires knowledge. How can you achieve knowledge? So for example, tefilas kelim. You send a katan to go tovel your kelim. Can a katan tovel your kli? Yes. I'll tell you a secret. If you put your kli on the edge of the kelim mikvah, and a strong wind comes and knocks it into the kelim mikvah, is your kli tovel? Yeah, it's good. A monkey can tovel your kelim. The wind can tovel your kelim. A katan certainly can tovel your kelim. The problem is, how do you know when they come home, mommy, abba, I'm back from the kelim mikvah, how do you know they taka toveled it? So the Shulchan Aruch records, you need a gadol omid agabav, you need somebody who is trustworthy, who witnessed. So you could take your katanim children and divvy up the kelim, and everybody's helping you. They can tovel, but it needs a trustworthy person who can testify. So I found the psak of Rav Yashiv Zatzal. He talked about what if there's a adult at the kelim mikvah who will call you and say, yeah, I'm here with your kid, I just saw them, that's good enough. Is it over the phone? Is that good enough? And I wondered the second, this is what I wrote the article about. What if you FaceTime with your kid while they tovel? Is that good enough? Well, if it required ne'emanus and edus, so you can't have two witnesses who watch a chuppah over FaceTime. They need to be present. That needs edus. It requires ne'emanus. It's an edus l'kiyam adavar versus a birur adavar. We gave another chabur that was a separate topic. But there requires edus and ne'emanus. In the case of tefilas kelim, or Rav Moshe was machadish, your milk, or an erev, what you need is yediya. You have to arrive at knowledge. You lav dafka, you don't necessarily need testimony and witnesses. You need knowledge. You could arrive at the knowledge in this indirect fashion. So Rav Moshe was Machadish. He wasn't the only one, but Rav Moshe most famously was Machadish, that the strict regulations and the severe consequences in this country of the milk being anything other than what they say it is the equivalent of a yediya. The Jew has knowledge of where it comes from. So it's not that those relying on Rav Moshe drink Chalav Akum. Chas v'shalom, none of us are entitled to drink Chalav Akum. We're not allowed. We all have to drink only Chalav Yisrael. The machlokas is, does Chalav Yisrael mean a Jew saw it? Or does it mean if you arrived at the yediyah, the knowledge of it, even indirectly, that would be good enough? So if you're on a ship and you drink what we call Chalav Stam, meaning it's not Chalav Yisrael, the Jew wasn't there, but we have the yediyah of where it came from, then you can rely. If the milk on the ship, by the way, it's a long ship, and you've come to port in other places and they've replenished the milk and it's not from America, then you can't necessarily rely on Rav Moshe's psak. Right. I last summer, celebrating a wonderful family milestone, had the great privilege of being in Europe, first in Switzerland, then in Italy. And it was unclear to me, and I tried to investigate, whether you could rely on Rav Moshe's psak in those countries. And what I found was a enormous machlokas of the Jewish communities there, of what you could or you couldn't, or you can, but we say you can't, or what, it was very complicated to get to a... I'll tell you one thing that I tried to emphasize to my children on this trip, and I myself felt very strongly coming back, is just how blessed and fortunate we are in this country and how much we take for granted the ease with which we can keep kosher. You can go into a supermarket in any city in the United States of America, I don't care if they have a Jewish population of zero, and you can buy not hundreds, but thousands of kosher products. And in most cities in Europe, you walk into a supermarket and it can have an enormous Jewish population and you can't make heads or tails of what you can buy and what you can eat and where you can go and what you can do. And it's yet another bracha that we are able to enjoy here. So back to breakfast. We're having breakfast together. So back to breakfast. We talked about eggs. So if you drink regular milk, you have to know where the milk came from. If the ship is still using the milk that began in America and you drink the milk relying on Rav Moshe's heter, then you can continue to consume that milk. What about the cereal? And what about the utensils? Again, obviously you have to know that the cereal is kosher. Can you use non-kosher utensils? So the Shulchan Aruch here tells us, well, let's see. That utensil, even if it's not kosher, what made that utensil non-kosher? Because it previously was used with non-kosher. So the same spoon that you're going to use to consume your Raisin Bran cereal out of the bowl with the milk, that same spoon was used in order to cut the piece of bacon yesterday from the person who on the shmorg line on the ship used the spoon, the knife, the fork to cut the bacon. And now you want to use that fork and knife to cut your grapefruit. Now you want to use that spoon to eat your cereal. So Shulchan Aruch says, well, what would the problem be? The only way that you'd have a problem of transferring that bacon taste from yesterday to your food today would be if you had heat. If you had a source of heat, or call it harifus. But if you had heat, so if you're having cold cereal, so the Shulchan Aruch, no, so if you assume it's clean, you look at it and you can see it's clean, then you have no problem with mamashas of the actual food item or food stuff. So we can assume it's clean. It's clean and it's cold. So the Shulchan Aruch says, B'derach Arai, on occasion you can use non-kosher utensils as long as you're consuming something cold out of it. Which also is relevant to a business meeting, a hotel, a cruise, and so on, that to be able to eat the cereal, we have occasionally, I'm getting too old for it now, but in the summer we drive up to New York when we take vacation. I'm way too old for it now. So when I book one or two hotels to stay with my kids at, the favorite part of the whole vacation is you get them like the cheapest hotel, but it has that breakfast where they can make a hot chocolate and they can eat the cereal out of a bowl. They're so excited. That was like, oh, the biggest luxury. They got to have the cereal out of that bowl. So you could have cereal out of that bowl. Derech Arai. In other words, should you bring non-kosher utensils into your home and use them only for cold? No. Shulchan Aruch says to do so consistently would be to flirt with disaster. But on occasion, when it's cold and it's clean, it can't impact the food you're eating out of it. If the food is kosher and the kli is cold and clean, then you're okay to go. So on that breakfast line, you'd be able to eat cereal out of that kli. In theory, ice cream, if you knew the ice cream was kosher, and they scoop it and put it in a kli with a spoon, you'd be able to use it for those things. Just all the questions, I want to just get through. You could ask me. I'm happy to talk about it afterwards. What about, because we have a few other areas to talk about. So coming back, let's discuss very briefly the insects. Let's discuss the insects. Let's discuss the insects. So we mentioned you could have cut up vegetables, and you can have cut up fruit, but you can't have any leafy items or those things which might have infestation of insects. Why not? Why don't we just say that if they have an infestation of insects, well, we all, again, here's where the Jewish knowledge, a little knowledge, can be dangerous. In the area of kashrus, we are blessed to have wonderful proprietors and owners and Jewish and non-Jewish, and they're all fantastic. That said, often it's the Jewish ones and the ones who have a little knowledge who are much harder to supervise. See, the non-Jew who wants you to supervise their establishment, whatever time to do, they do. Then you get the Jew who had a little bit of a Jewish education. They say, why are you making me do this? I know I could do that, and I once learned this, and I think I once heard of that. And that's when you get into all kinds of challenges. So you'll say, why can't I have romaine lettuce? Why can't I have broccoli? If there's a tiny little bugle in the broccoli, if there's a little thrip, or there's a little, who cares? It's going to be batel b'shishim. Everybody knows. It's going to be nullified 1 in 60. And if it's nullified 1 in 60, I'm good to go. So you have a little bit more than just a little knowledge. So you know that we have a halachic problem of burial. Last year in our Shas Sugyas, if you didn't hear it, you can listen to it online, we did one or two shiurim on the sugya of beria. Beria comes up in three areas of halacha. Fascinatingly, the halacha of beria. One of them is, I don't remember what they were, a bracha achrona. Maybe even if what you consumed was smaller than the minimum measure, but it was an entire entity, the Mishnah Berurah talks about a whole grape. You ate the whole grape. It's a beria of a grape. So that was one area. And we talked about What's the shear of Isser? That normally you have to consume a minimum measure in order to violate the prohibition. But if you ate a beria, an entire unit, even if it was less than the minimum measure, you'd violate the Isser. And the third area was bittel, that beria ain't a bottle. That in the area of nullification, if it's a whole unit, you can't consider it to be nullified. We went through a lumdus, we went through a chakira. Why is it that beria ain't a bottle? Why is beria in Isser, even when it's less than the shear, the minimum measure? The Griz on Nazir, the Briskarav, had a chakira. Is it that it has a chashivas, even less than a kazayas? Normally, you only violate the prohibition of eating a non-kosher food when it's a minimum measure of a kazayas, the size of an olive. Why? Because less than that's negligible. In order to violate a prohibition, you have to do something more than that which is negligible. Lahavdil, it's like in order to get a ticket for speeding, if you went more than 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. I never met anyone who got a ticket. If the speed limit was 55, I've never seen anyone pulled over for going 56. Now the speed limit says 55. That's the law. That's what's proper to do. But if you go 56, that's not... So halacha says you're not... That you get into the issue of chatzishir, Yochanan Reish Lakish, chatzishir asur min haTorah, and so on. But halacha says the minimum measure that's not negligible because it has a chashivas, it has a significance to it, is a kazayas. So what if you achieve chashivas, but less than the kazayas? So the first side of the chakira says beria is asur. The reason beria has this unique status, this unit of beria, is because it has a chashivas even when it's less than that amount. And the other opinion says no. The reason a beria is prohibited is because when the Torah calls something prohibited, the Torah said, that is asur. So normally when the Torah says, that is asur, we know that that means a kazayas or more. But when the Torah says, that is asur, and it means a beria of that, then you have a problem, it's prohibited. So what's an example of a beria, of a whole unit, which has these three exceptions, these rules? A namala, a bug, an ant, giranosha, Of Tameh, Aver Menachai. These are all examples that Chazal consider to be a beria, its own unit. Again, we went through how do you define a beria? A big machlokas harishonim. Is it the name? Is it what defines something as a beria? When is something not a beria? We went through this sugya with many, many nafkaminas. So we know, therefore, that if a bug is in your food, it's not batal. It doesn't matter what ratio against that bug, the bug is a beria, it's not batal. If the bug is chopped up at that point, then it's no longer a beria, it's no longer a whole unit, and then it would be permissible. Are you allowed to chop it up lechatchila? No, why? So can you go to a juicing store and order a juice cocktail that's going to have vegetables that when they put in, it's going to have raspberries and strawberries and things that regularly have challenges with insects? What about, is the person behind the counter doing that for you considered? So there's a big discussion about what you can order at a juicing place. Are they mevatalit for you? Is that you're being mevatalit? Or no, you just ordered your drink and that's how they make it. So the result is that it's chopped up and it's batal as something which is chopped up at that point. But a beria is not batal. A beria is ain't a batal, and therefore we have to check. Now when do you have to check? You have to be choshesh for everything. So first of all, halacha says only that which can be seen with the naked eye. If it can only be perceived with a magnifying glass, it's not halachically significant. Anything not visible to the naked eye has no significance in halacha. Rav David Cohen, the Gvul Yaivitz, when he came here for a Shabbos several years ago, gave a shir on brain death. And his opinion, it's a radical opinion, but his entire opinion about brain death is that it's not visible by the naked eye. And this notion, this halachic principle, that Rav Moshe was very strong about, he incorporates even to his opinion about brain death itself. Something that needs a measuring instrument, something that needs a magnifying glass, is not something which is halachically significant. This came up a lot with the water in New York that might have had the bugs in them. What if they're only visible with an instrument or a magnifying glass? So first of all, it has to be something that you see. The reason that we are trained, our mashkichim, let's say of the ORB, but all good kashrus agencies, they use light boxes and they use this and they use that, not because they don't subscribe to that standard. It has to be visible to the naked eye. But what they're saying is they're looking for that which is visible for the naked eye in a way that's much easier on the naked eye. In other words, it's trying to be good to the eye. It's just easier to find it that way. But if you're holding a magnifying glass, whether you're looking at your esrog or you're looking for a bug in your vegetable, then you're doing something that's not halachic. You're doing it maybe because you have OCD or some other reason altogether. Now, bugs are very, very significant. I know that there are people who are lenient on this. I know people who keep Shabbos very strictly, but they say, this is for the frummies, this is for the right-wingers, this is for the Taliban, this is for the new generation. The new generation of black hatters, they're the ones who check for bugs. We never checked for bugs. This is new. We don't do it. It's not true. First of all, I remember asking when I was learning Yerodea for Smicha, I asked my wife's grandparents who grew up in Hungary if they remember checking for bugs growing up, and they said, absolutely. This is not a newfangled idea. The reason that many may not be familiar is depending on what climate and what environment where you live and what infestation rates are will impact what you have to do. So for example, if you're in Israel, you know that everybody in Israel checks flour. But in America, you don't check flour with a sifter. Right? Maybe used to. Today, you don't check flour with a sifter. Everyone in Israel checks beans. In America, you're not as careful. You don't need to. So it depends on where you are. Can impact the infestation, rates. So this is not a newfangled idea to halacha. Not only is it halacha, but you need to understand and appreciate, even relatively speaking, the significance of this halacha. How many lavin, how many biblical prohibitions can you violate by consuming one thrip, by consuming one bug? So the Gemara at the end of Makos, you can violate up to six or more of 11 biblical prohibitions. Not every bug, not every time, but you can violate. So you have people who are so strict not to violate a Durabanan on Shabbos. So careful not to overstep a Durabanan on Shabbos. Most of electricity today is a Durabanan. As observant Jews, it's unimaginable to us a Shomer Shabbos Yid would ever engage something electric on Shabbos in a non-life-threatening situation. And most electrics are abundant, yet eating a bug can be up to six biblical prohibitions, and some are negligent when it comes, and we need to be careful. We need to know there's no shortage of kashrus resources that can help us know different vegetables, different checking strategies, and so on and so forth. So how do you know when you have to check and when you don't? So halacha distinguishes between essentially three categories of foods. There's something that has a muchzak nagua, some foods that are muchzak as having bugs. They always need to be checked. And then you could have a mir she'eno matzoi and a mir ha-matzoi. Sometimes you have a significant minority and you have an insignificant minority. So how do you define that? The Rivash famously says 50%. Less than 50% is a mir she'eno matzoi.
What?
In order to define it, the Rivash says the notion is 50%. A lenient approach. A mir ha-matzoi is an infestation rate of nearly half, a little under 50%. If it's nearly half, that's a mir ha-matzoi. If it's over 50%, it's not a mir, it's a rov. But if it's nearly 50%, that's the mir ha-matzoi. But in halacha and throughout halacha, most paschim like the Mishkanes Yankov, the Mishkanes Yaakov says 10%. 10% is considered to be a mir ha-matzoi. So that means to say, if you sample, you don't have to check everything, but if you sample it, and it has 10% of it, you find, now none of it can be consumed without checking it regularly. Which is what happens in big kashrus situations, where not necessarily are you checking everything. You're checking the sampling to determine whether it reaches that threshold of mir ha-matzoi to know how much more you have to check. But people who know what they're doing, they'll check broccoli, romaine, leafy vegetables. If they know what they're doing, it's a mir ha-matzoi. You'll almost always find. There was actually a video going around, I think last week or the week before, not of a Jewish source, it was a non-Jewish source, who you never know what's going to go viral, but they were looking at some vegetable under a really, really intense microscope, magnified many, many times, and when people saw just exactly how much of a farm is going on over there on your piece of lettuce, what you're about to eat for lunch that you don't notice, people really responded. We don't have to
magnify.
Right, we don't have to. But my point is that many who say, what are you talking about? I never found a bug. It's not going to be a dead fly. That too you'll find, by the way. But it's not a dead bee or a dead fly or an entire iguana that's inside your iceberg lettuce, your romaine lettuce. But if you know what you're looking for, some people here have worked as mashkichim, some are currently working as mashkichim. If you know what you're looking for, take anybody's head of lettuce, and you can often find it. So I don't want to belabor this point, but only to share it with you to say, that a person has to be careful. We're talking about many, many, many lavim. So when it comes to the cut up vegetables that have no infestation problem, red pepper, green pepper, celery, carrots, and the like, you're okay. But those that have a mir on matzo, you're having a problem, you would need to know that it doesn't have the problem in order to consume it. The last area, and I want to close with this for our last 10 minutes or so, is the area of Bishul Akum. Now, why is the area of Bishul Akum significant? There's a ton to talk about. Those who are part of the Smichas Chaver know that we spent months and months on Bishul Akum, and many took a Bechina and passed, so they can tell you about Bishul Akum. Where does Bishul Akum come in? Because I'm trying to help you enjoy your cruise. And, you know, these frozen nuked meals, you'll be sick on your cruise in no time. And how many red peppers can you eat? How many cut-up carrots can you eat already? So are there any other things that we can add? So what would be the status of a double-wrapped baked potato? Could you ask your server if they could take a raw potato, double wrap it in tin foil, throw it in any oven because the double wrapping will ensure it's kashrus, and then you can enjoy a double wrap baked potato. You can have a hot potato. Can they take a corn on the cob raw, double wrap it in some tin foil, and throw it in an oven? I'll go one more. Can they take a piece of salmon, double wrap it in tin foil, and throw it in an oven? It'll steam delicious salmon. It'll come out, sprinkle some salt on it, some margarine, and you'll eat like a mensch. You'll have a freshly cooked, delicious food out in the middle of the ocean, in the middle of the sea. What are the halachic standards? So there are kashrus issues. First of all, how do you know that what they said they put, and that they put it in a position that was clean? How do you know the baked potato was clean, and the baked potato wasn't sitting next to the chazashmaltz, and now they made you a double-wrapped, baked of chazashmaltz potato? It's probably delicious, but it also is totally not kosher. So you probably can rely on the fact that if they washed it, said they washed it, they washed it. If you say, I'm allergic to everything else, the standards are very strict, especially on a ship. They're not going to take a risk that you say you're allergic to animal products, and now that there's something on it, if they wash the potato, they wash the potato. They double wrap in the tinfoil. You get it, and you can see that it was double wrapped and sealed all around. You unwrap that double wrapped potato. You can trust that it was raw, and it was clean, and it was double wrapped. But what about the fact that no Jew had any part of the cooking process? Why is that a problem? So the Mishnah of Arazor Daf Lamed Hay and the Gemara there on Lamed Ches tell us of the prohibition of Bishul Akum. It's the same Mishnah of Chalav Akum that we talked about. There's a prohibition of Bishul Akum. Even if all the ingredients are kosher, if a non-Jew was involved in the cooking process from the beginning to the end, it renders your food not kosher. Not only does it render your food non-kosher, the Shulchan Aruch even records, the kli, your kosher kli in which it was cooked, will absorb a non-kosher taste and need to be kashered. Many or most don't know that. If you have a housekeeper living at home, and they violate Bishul Akum using your kli needs to be kashered. There are certain leniencies in a Teirim because certain Rishonim thought Bishul Akum doesn't apply in a home setting with a non-kosher housekeeper. But Shulchan Aruch at least explicitly says that such a kli would need to be kashered, would need to be purged of the non-kosher taste produced by Bishul Akum, even when or if all the ingredients themselves were kosher. Why did the rabbis invent this prohibition of Bishul Akum? This is machlokas between the Rambam and Rashi. It's really 2 days in Rashi and the Rambam. Is the prohibition Mishim Chasnas? That's the opinion that we follow, that they were worried about intermarriage. You know how you're going to socialize? You know what will lead to children meeting one another and intermarriage? Is when we break bread together. It's also the same margin of Pas Akum and Pas Yisrael and Pas Palter. But if we consume meals together, if we socialize together, that's when we're going to integrate together. And integrate together means we're going to assimilate together. If Shlomo Zalman said that this horrific assimilation rate in America and the intermarriage rate in America, when we're lax in these rules that we think, some think are archaic, arcane, irrelevant, we see the consequence of being lax in these boundaries that we place. Person's lenient in Bishul Akum and Pas Akum and Chol of Akum, and we have a 70% intermarriage rate, Rachmana Litzlan, in this country. So one reason that's given is Mishim Chasnas. The other reason given is Shema, because maybe if someone's not careful, the non-Jew doesn't know how to keep kosher. So they think they got all kosher ingredients. But just like the person whose child is not allergic to peanuts will never be as careful as the person whose child is allergic, if you're not allergic to non-kosher, even with your best intentions of making a meal for me, you could, by accident, make me something which is non-kosher. Rabbi Moskowitz, can I have 5 more minutes? Do you mind? Perfect. 5 more minutes. I'm sorry. I just want to finish up the cruise considerations. What's a nafkamina between the Rambam and Rashi? What's a nafkamina between these two reasons? The Pesachei Tshuva quotes a nafkamina. What about a non-observant Jew? If the reason is chasnus intermarriage, there's no such thing as intermarriage with a non-observant Jew. Yisrael af bishachata Yisraelu. They're always a Jew. If the reason is maybe someone who's not as careful and non-kosher will end up by accident producing for you non-kosher, then maybe you should apply bishalakim even to a non-observant Jew. And we are makel on that question. We do not, for the most part, apply the prohibition of bishalakim to the non-observant Jew. So the reason that we follow is because of chasnus. It could lead to intermarriage. Socializing, integrating, assimilating will lead to intermarriage. So Chazal, who instituted this prohibition, also created three loopholes out. And they said only food items, only recipes, only food that would be consumed in a social setting is subject to the prohibition of bishalakim. But food that would never be eaten in a social setting is in itself not a candidate or subject to the prohibition of bishalakim. And what are the three exceptions that they had? Therefore, food which is ne'achal kamo shu'chai, anything that could be eaten raw, if it could be eaten raw, the fact that the non-Jew cooked it doesn't impact you. You could have eaten it raw anyway, and something like that would not be subject to bishul akum. The second is, eina ole al shulchan malachim. If something would not be served at a state dinner, if it wouldn't be served in a fancy setting, then it's not subject to bishul akum. If it wouldn't be served at a state dinner. You know, it's hard to know now. This current administration had guests where they celebrated having brought in McDonald's or Burger King. I forgot what the story was. So again, how do you define? The Queen's own family is defecting. So I don't know what's considered what you'd serve at a state dinner or a royal dinner. It's hard to define. And the Jew as a part of the process, it's a big machlokas. Time doesn't allow us. A big machlokas, Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, Mechaber Ramah, what amount of the part of the cooking process do you have to have in order for it to be called Bishul Yisrael? Is it just lighting a fire? What if the fire was lit from a fire originally lit by a Jew? Even this fire wasn't lit by a Jew, but the fire was lit from a... In other words, the Jew lit the pilot light, and 7.5 years later, when they did the Siyum HaShas, the non-Jew lit a new fire from the pilot light lit by the Jew 50 years ago. Is that considered Bishul Yisrael? It's a big discussion halacha. Kashrus agencies want it to be Bishul Yisrael in places where Jews don't even live. They invented many years ago already. The Star K relied on this. Different kashrus agencies have different mechanisms. Today with technology, it's even simpler. With your app, somebody just installed an oven in their home here. I'm on Montoya Circle. They told me about this oven. You control the oven from your phone. So the husband and father can be out of town on vacation, and they need the housekeeper to make the kids dinner, and in order for it to not be bishul akum, what, $3.50 for 45 minutes? No problem. You could be in Cancun, you go on your phone, you turn the oven on in your home on Montoya Circle, and it's not bishul akum because the Jew turned the oven on. So to what degree does the Jew have to be involved? That would be fine in an Ashkenazi home. A Sephardi home would need you to actually add the ingredient, the pot, and so on and so forth. That's also very important because in most kosher supervisions, most vad hakashrus of most communities meet the Ashkenazi standards, not the Sephardi standards. So Sephardim, when they eat out, need to know. Rav Avadia has tshuvas, and in Yalki Yosef talks about a Sephardi bachur learning in an Ashkenazi yeshiva. Can he rely on the Ramaz kulas of Bishul Akam? Or does he have to bring in his own food or only go to a Sephardi yeshiva and so on? There are all these conversations. So now the question becomes, what is defined as Ola Ashokha Malachim, something that would only be served at a state dinner? What is defined as something Nechal Kamosha Hu Chai? Something that could be eaten raw. So let's talk about salmon. So Shulchan Aruch writes also in Yer Deya that there's, in order to consume a fish, it has to have two simanim. What are the simanim for a fish? Fins and scales. It has to have fins and scales in order to be kosher. There's one exception, says the Shulchan Aruch, and that is salmon. The color of the flesh of the fish itself testifies to where it came from. So every other fish, you have to see it filleted. You have to know it had fins and scales. But a salmon, which is why at Costco, for many years already, we talk about even the cut-up pieces of salmon. At Costco, a person could purchase the frozen, the raw, because we know that they're done without mixing with other fish. And if you know the color of the flesh of the fish, you're okay. Some kosher agencies are strict on this, and they say today, all kinds of food colorings are introduced to other fish to make them look fresh or to sell them for a higher price to make them look like salmon. So can you still rely on it? But I believe the Oyuz Pesach is that you can still rely on the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says, salmon is salmon. You can see without fins and scales. You're good to go. So salmon, the kashrus of salmon is the kashrus of salmon. What about bishul akum? Is salmon nechal kamo shu'chai? So if we were learning together 20 years ago, 50 years ago, you'd look at me, it would be a very short conversation. Is salmon eaten when it's raw? What is the matter with you? You'd look at me and say. But today, in 2020, there's not a kosher pizza store, a kosher bakery, a kosher yogurt store that doesn't also have sushi. Sushi. You can't make a birthday, an anniversary, a l'chaim, a vort, without sushi. Sushi. So the question is, so even if you would have asked me this 5 years ago, and Rav Shechter's Pesach 5 years ago was, it's still not Nechal Kamo Shulchai. Why? Because not all fish is eaten raw. It only has to be sushi-grade fish. But I did a little research in Smichas Chaver, and I asked Rav Shechter when he was here, and he agreed. As it turns out, I asked this to one of our local proprietors, they do not buy sushi-grade fish in order to make their sushi. What they do is they flash-freeze the fish. Flash-freezing the fish kills any bacteria in it, and it renders any fish the level of sushi grade. And apparently that is a normative practice. And assuming that that's true, it means that all fish, assuming that's true, fish is ne'achal kamo shu'chai, as sushi's become ubiquitous and available, and people enjoy it, and they eat it. It's as Jewish these days as gefilte fish. So therefore, it might meet the standard of ne'achal kamo shu'chai. Now there's another question in fish, because Rav Shechter holds that you follow, in order to define if it's nechal kamo shu'chai, you follow the ikar ingredient. So if you're eating sashimi, just the raw fish, it's the only thing, that's nechal kamo shu'chai. But let's say you're having a roll of sushi. A roll of sushi also has rice. Which is the key ingredient in it? I'll ask you this, what bracha do you make? So if Shechter points out, you make a mizonos, which means you're treating the rice as the core ingredient. And if the rice is the key ingredient, the rice is Ola Shulcha Malachim, and it's not Nechal Kamo Shulchai, and therefore it might be a problem of Bishalakim because of the rice. Others disagree, and they say, no, the fish, the rice is just holding the fish, it's complementing the fish is the main ingredient. So whether you could order salmon on the cruise, in principle and in theory you could. It's not a problem of bishalakum because it's nechal kamo shu'chai, because all salmon today could be used in sushi. Not only sushi grade salmon, all salmon could. It's nechal kamo shu'chai. The flesh testifies to its origin, it's all kosher. The challenge you have is if you order double wrap piece of salmon on a cruise or an hotel, how do you know what knife was used to cut it? How do you know? So can you rely on the vegetables that by the time they got to your piece of salmon, if there were something on the knife, it came off on earlier fish? We apply that to vegetables. We don't really apply that to fish. We allow you to go into any supermarket and get salmon, but we tell you have to clean the knife first and clean the scale or put a new piece of wax paper down. So if you could figure out a way of knowing that salmon was clean or the knife that was used to cut it was clean, then in theory a double wrap piece of salmon, even in a non-kosher oven and even put there by a non-Jew, would be okay. I used to say, see if you can throw it in the oven. But the cruise lines won't let any passengers in their kitchen. Absolutely, very, very strict about it. Hotel setting might be different. If you can talk your way into the kitchen, you could throw the potato in, you could throw the salmon in, you can, even if the oven's not kosher, if it's double wrapped, you'd be able to consume it. What about the potato? Potato is not eaten raw. Is a potato Ola Shulchan Malachim? So here's a big machlokas. And we'll end with this because I feel bad keeping my dear friend waiting. But the machlokas is as follows. It's a fascinating machlokas. How do you define Ola Ashulchan Malachim, something eligible to be served at a state at a royal dinner? Is it served in that state? Are you following the substance or the form? The ingredient or the recipe? What do I mean to say? Potato chips are never getting served at a state dinner. But I've been to plenty of weddings that had a beautiful baked potato where the top was squeezed out of a mold and looked on top of the potato, you know, half a baked potato with a mold and a swirl on top of it could easily be served at a wedding or a state dinner or a royal affair. So how do you judge the potato? By the potato, it could be a potato chip, could be French fries, they're not being served in a royal setting, or it could be a fancy schmancy formed, swirled, floured baked potato. So that's a big, big machlokas. Rav Moshe Sternbach, Shlita, Rav Sternbach holds that potatoes, because they can be served in any form at a state dinner, in any form, they're considered Ola Shulcha Malachim, and they're subject to the prohibition of Bishal Akam. Others, the Aruch HaShulchan said, not potatoes. Potatoes are, who fancy people eat potatoes? Potatoes are the staple of the person who can't get fancier food or better food. And therefore, he says potatoes are not Ola Shulcha Malachim. So there's a big machlokas about potatoes. Rav Moshe Sternbach would say that potato chips are subject to Bishal Akum, even though the potato chip in its form would never be served, but the potato in its substance would, and therefore it's olah shulchan malachim. So it's a big machlokas on this. Depending on how you paskin, will determine whether you can order a baked potato on a cruise that's double wrapped, that you know was raw, was clean, was double wrapped, and you got it. There's no kashrus issue because of the double wrap. There may not be a bishul akum problem because it's not olah shulchan malachim, even though it's not edible, which is raw. So we covered a lot of subjects. We talked Shabbos. Today we talked about kashrus. I'll just end with, what if a person needs to go to the mikvah while they're on a cruise? So you probably didn't bring the mikvah lady with you. But the halacha is you're allowed to use the ocean. Not only are you allowed to use the ocean, the halacha would be, now a person, we have a derabanan that you need to be checked over. A person can't see their own back. How do you know if you have loose hairs, you have a chatzitza on one's back? That's the whole institution of a mikvah lady, is to help the person confirm that there is no chatzitza. Assuming you didn't take the mikvah lady on the cruise with you, then you should have someone else check you over. And b'diavad, even a person's husband, a woman's husband, who normally shouldn't see her in that state until she's come out of the mikvah, but in the process of being able to go to the mikvah, the husband can serve as the mikvah lady in that unusual circumstance, she could go. Not only could she go in, the Shulchan Aruch even records, and we use this. Normally there cannot be a chatzitza, a barrier whatsoever. In our mikvah, women who go to the mikvah regularly can't be wearing anything, can't have a chatzitza. Just today I got a shayla about stitches and chatzitza. They come up each and every week, each and every day, a chatzitza shaylas. However, Shulchan Aruch already mentions, and we follow this when it comes to gerus today. You can imagine in our very sensitive society, we have to be exceedingly careful today. We had manufactured, someone in our community sewed multiple sizes, but a very baggy, loose-fitting, like a gown, that we tested and the water goes through. And when we convert women for the Beis Din who have to be present, we used to hold up a sheet and look over just at the top of the head. Very complicated and very intimidating and uncomfortable for all parties involved. Today, when we convert women, they wear this loose-fitting baggie that water we know gets through and that was immersed in the water even before we come in, they with it, so that when they immerse, they're entirely surrounded with no chatzitza. That would not serve as a chatzitza. In theory, if a person had a scenario where they needed the mikvah and there was only the ocean or a lake, again, there's different halachas of a mikvah, mayan, not for now. And lastly, when the cruise is complete, a person should bench gomel. The halacha is, among the four people, is crossing the desert and being released from prison, recovering from illness, and crossing the sea. So a person comes back from a cruise, then they should bench gomel. And the Shulchan Aruch records, preferably the benching of gomel should happen within 3 days of the cruise. I wish everyone a very happy vacation, a festive holiday. Enjoy your cruise. If you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. But we continue with Rabbi Moskowitz's shiur now.